You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A universe of Hollywood storytelling and intrigue awaits you now. Unlock the secret history of Hollywood by going to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. The moon hung low and limp in the August sky, kissing the tip of the frost-capped mountains on the horizon. The garden behind the palatial house was alive with the perfume of summer. A girl in an evening gown smiled as she descended the steps to the lawn and slipped off her shoe, brushing her bare toes faintly across the grass. From the house behind her, voices murmured instructions. A gramophone sang the last notes of a concerto, and the remains of dinner were swept from the table by busy servants. Footsteps approached down the steps, slowing as they reached her. She glanced around to see her host slip his thick woolen jacket from his shoulders and wrap it around her own. "In case you are cold," he whispered into her ear. The girl smiled and looked away at the garden, trying her best not to grimace in disgust. Her host's breath carried with it the sweet decay of turned milk. She shivered and instinctively shrank into the warmth of the man's coat, but as she did so, the stale tang of fetid sweat that hung around the coat began to reach her. Swiftly and gracefully, she freed herself from the sweat-soaked jacket and held it out towards him. "But it is such a beautiful summer," she said. "How could you suppose that I should be cold?" For a moment, she wondered if the goose flesh along her arms would betray her. But the man shrugged, threw his jacket back on, and took her hand. They walked onto the lawn, he in his heavy, crumpled brown suit and sensible shoes, and she, the vision of elegance, in a silken evening gown that clung magnetically to her otherwise naked form. She busied herself by drinking in the sights around them, the high, sloping rockeries that ran on either side, the bursts of edelweiss and alpine roses that caught each ray of devoted moonlight. In the distance, the faint music of a street festival. As for her host, the garden could be damned. His eyes hung unashamedly on every detail of her body as she walked, at the blinking glimpse of her toes as they appeared from beneath her gown to take another step, at the sublime perfection of her smile, the plunging, smooth neck, the shoulder, the chest. This enchanted beauty sent from heaven alone with him in his domain. He grunted and clumsily smoothed her arm with his hand. The skin of his palm was rough like brick. Was this guy serious? Since arriving, she'd heard nothing but zealous, unquestioning praise of this man, of the hypnotizing internal fire in his eyes and the angry music in his voice that had enchanted a million men. To her, he was a pale, crumpled slob with bad breath and a body odor problem. And yet, this was the man who could make her a star, and she needed to charm him. At the edge of the garden, barely concealed by moon shadow, two stoic bodyguards observed the scene in silence. She glanced back at her host with his tie slightly askew, with the brown, damp stains around the neckline of his once white shirt and the sticky fleck of elastic spittle that clung like a limpet to the corner of his lower lip. Stardom be damned. If she was going to have to kiss this guy, then she would at least do it in private. "My goodness," she gasped, gazing about. "The garden is so lovely, and the view across the mountains is so truly inspiring." She brought her hand to her chest and sighed. "But must we be fettered by your bodyguards? I'm not accustomed to chaperones." Her host stared intently at her breasts and then glanced up. "Do you not trust me?" she smiled. "I can assure you that I'm harmless." His eyes swept the length of her body once more and then met her eyes. "Temptress, you flirt with me." She giggled and blushed. It was a move she'd learned early in her teens, and it had never failed. "I'm an honest coquette," she said. "If I flirt, then I flirt with an attractive man who is unattainable. Is that not so?" He turned this thought in his mind and then glanced back over his shoulder and barked a command. The men in the shadows nodded and hurried to the house. They were alone, save for the music of the street festival some miles away that floated in across the air like a ribbon. She took a breath and steeled her resolve. "You see," she began, but the sentence was broken by his mouth, which landed painfully on hers, splitting her lip. His left hand grabbed at her breasts, and his right began to haul up her evening dress, searching for a way underneath. Ambushed, she began to tumble backwards until she fell with a thump against the wall. The taste of his tongue was repulsive as it pressed its way around her teeth. His hand wrenched painfully at her breast. She felt the night air against her legs as her dress was hauled roughly up as he pressed himself against her. "Stop," she managed. You're hurting me." "No more flirting," he hissed. "You excite me." He ground his body against hers once more, his clammy tongue pressing against her neck, moaning in exhilaration. And as he did, he broke wind loudly. The odor reached her nose almost immediately, and she grimaced, wriggling like a fish from his control and instantly coming to her senses. No stardom or promise of fortune or fame was worth the ordeal of allowing this man to have his way with her. "No," she spat, and began to fight against his grip, but his hands were iron clasps that held her and refused to budge. "Damn you, stop!" she screamed, and shuffling her hip to one side, she drew back her leg and launched her knee into his groin as powerfully as she could. Instantly, his grip on her vanished, and he staggered back, clutching at his injury, his face distorted in anguish, and an impossibly high-pitched howl of torment rising from somewhere in the depths of his chest. She caught her breath and pressed her hand to her bleeding lip, but even as her senses began to return to her, heavy footsteps had arrived, and the rough, gloved hands of four guards had seized her. Violently, they began to drag her across the lawn so quickly that she was unable to find her feet. Behind them, her host screamed orders, his voice still racked with high-pitched, bitter anguish. A light in a doorway and the puzzled expression on a butler's face. A melee of voices, of words echoing against stone walls. A corner being turned. A long, narrow stairway and then a large, dark wooden door, adorned with intricate carvings. They stopped here, and she wriggled in their grip as her host stormed his way ahead of them and began to wrench at a bunch of keys. Cursing, he selected one and thrust it into the lock, flung open the door and commanded the men to throw her onto the vast square bed, above which was hung a giant swastika. She landed in a tangle and twisted around to see the guards leave. Adolf Hitler threw the bolt on the door and limped angrily to the bed. "Madam," he spat, "I do not wish to force you, but if you do not give yourself willingly, I shall take what I want." With that, he grabbed at her dress and began to tear it roughly from her body. "My God," he gasped as her flesh was revealed, and threw himself upon her. Furiously, she began to pound on his arms, his shoulders, anywhere her fists could connect. "You disgusting bastard," she cried. "You ruined my dress. You are not my Führer. I am an American citizen. You can't treat me like one of your stupid Nazi women. I'm not your hostage, you disgusting bastard." "Tonight you're mine," he grinned, fumbling with his belt and holding open her legs with his knee. "And someday, you're America too." "You second-rate geyser! You couldn't conquer Staten Island!" Laughing, he held down her wrists with one hand and forced open his trousers with the other. She flung back her head and began to weep. No one was coming to save her. They could all hear what was going on, and no one was going to stop it. And then, as if whispered by an unseen friend, the answer came to her. Wide-eyed, she looked up at him as he began to press himself against her. "Stop," she cried. "Listen to me. I'm not worthy of you. If you take me, you'll be desecrating your Aryan heritage. You wouldn't rape a Jewish girl, would you?" He stared at her in bewilderment. "That's right," she said. "My grandfather was a Jew." Cursing, he sprang from the bed and dragged his trousers up, fastening his belt and shrinking away from her as though she were some hostile canine. She clutched her shredded clothing about her and fixed her dark eyes on his. 10 minutes later, she'd been bundled swiftly into a long black car, along with an armed guard who was under strict orders to expel this Jewish garbage from the country by whatever means possible. As she watched the twisting of the mountain roads from the window of her car, she smiled at the irony of the situation. Just a few years previously, she'd been snubbed by the Warner family for not being Jewish enough. And yet, tonight, the fact that she had a Jewish grandfather, a man named Aaron Rosenberg whose face she couldn't even recall, had saved the honor of Lena Basquette. Her recovery from her 1930s suicide attempt had taken months of isolated treatment. During quiet, reflective moments, she could still taste the poison in her mouth, could still feel it turn to needles as it passed down her throat. Upon leaving the hospital, she'd taken the last remaining dollars she'd been paid by Harry Warner and rented a room at the Hotel Warwick. The news hounds, freshly desperate to capitalize on this fallen mother now that an attempted suicide had failed, began to attack her telephone and camped out patiently in the hotel's lobby. Each day, Lena would open her newspaper to find a new sensation. The nurse who'd attended her bedside had noted no repentance in Lena's eyes for having sold her daughter. Hospital visitors had noticed her smoking without a care in the world. Former female acquaintances stated quite plainly that they'd never trusted Lena around their men. But there were also plus sides to this attention. Offers of work from Dust Bowl Studios on Poverty Row began to arrive, as did offers from various night spots. Hard cash for public appearances. As she was pondering these proposals, an offer arrived from theatre star Harry Richman, who was in the process of producing a review for his nightclub. Hoping to capitalize on the scandalous presence of Lena Basquette, he sent along an offer for 3 weeks' work to appear as his co-star. It had been years since Lena had appeared on the stage, and the idea of performing before a crowd once more, the nervous exhilaration of waiting to rush from the wings to the stage, appealed to her. She thought back to her time with the Ziegfeld Follies, and to before, when she was much younger, dancing in a tutu as her mother scowled from the shadows. She remembered emerging from the stage door with her fellow dancers to find a scrawny boy with sandy hair dancing next to an upturned hat and singing Yankee Doodle Dandy at the top of his voice. The men who passed by in their top hats and tails fished in their pockets for a coin and threw them down without even so much as looking at the boy. Lena watched the other girls giggle to each other and roll their eyes before hurrying away to catch streetcars. She snapped open the clasp on her lace purse and took from it a 50-cent piece. She walked down the remaining steps and up to the boy, who seemed to lose his breath as she approached, until when she was only a few feet from him, the performance stopped altogether and he regarded her with hypnotized eyes. She handed him the 50-cent piece and abruptly felt a hand clamp her shoulder. Roughly, she was dragged back into the milling crowd by her mother, who scolded her for having wasted her money on such a grubby urchin. As they were about to round the corner, she managed to glance back over her shoulder and saw the boy standing on his tiptoes, straining to get one last glimpse of her before her mother swept her out of sight. She'd always wondered what had happened to that boy. The contract to star in Harry Richmond's show was signed a day later, and for the first time in many months, Lena relaxed, hopeful that the high-profile show could lead to better things. A few days before rehearsals were due to start, she received an unexpected visitor. She opened the door of her apartment to find a nervous-looking and slightly over-groomed Harry Cohn, the foul-mouthed head of Columbia Pictures, perhaps the most reviled man in all of Hollywood at the time. Being a short man, Cohn seemed determined to tower over all around him in every other way. At a board meeting, he once faced stiff opposition from those seated around him when he began to talk of expansion. Only one executive seemed to agree with Cohn, and together they successfully battled to change the other executives' minds. Upon leaving the meeting, Cohn approached the man who'd supported him, shook his hand, and fired him on the spot. "Every time I see you from now on, I'll know that I owe you a favor, and I can't have that," he told him. His casting couch was practically threadbare from the endless string of starlets he bedded in return for career favors. Each and every girl who passed through his doors on the way to the sound stages was given the option of advancing more swiftly if they'd accompany him to the bedroom. Those that refused found their careers stalled, or sometimes over completely. He relentlessly pursued Rita Hayworth, who consistently turned his advances down. Luckily for her, she was an instant star at Columbia, and her career did not suffer. Other actresses who were subjected to his unwanted advances at the time included Kim Novak and Joan Crawford, whose careers were too bulletproof to be torn down for having refused him. Those who dared to enter his office were greeted with the sight of King Cohn, as he came to be known, seated at a ridiculously oversized desk some 40 feet away from the door. Those brave enough to continue would make their way towards him and eventually arrive to find that the seats for visitors were lower than the average chair, causing his guests to almost squat as they sat, while he would look down on them from his specially raised armchair. Behind him, the wall proudly bore a framed picture of Benito Mussolini, a man that Cohn had met in 1933 and had greatly admired. But King Cohn's magisterial presence could be felt in every corner of the Columbia backlot. Crew that took slightly too long on their breaks would be sharply reprimanded by the mounted loudspeakers that hung high in every corner of the studio. Harry Cohn's voice would roughly bellow for them to
"get back to fucking work,"
or to
"stop canoodling behind that fucking backdrop,"
or
"hurry up and get that fucking take, time is fucking money."
At first, the startled population of Columbia wondered how he could possibly be so omniscient. They later learned that King Cohn had gone to great expense to have the entire Columbia kingdom bugged with concealed microphones. So hated had he become by his death in 1958 that at his funeral, a rabbi was asked to say one nice thing about him and replied, "He's dead." The funeral itself was attended by almost 1,000 people, News crews reporting on the event were taken aback by the scale of attendees, and initially raised the opinion that Cohn must have been a popular guy. After interviewing several of the mourners, however, it soon became clear that most people had just turned up to make sure he was dead. Red Skelton, who attended the funeral, took a long look at the monstrous mass of people around him and said with a grin, "Well, it only goes to show you. If you give the people what they want, they'll come out for it." Lena had known Harry Cohn for a while now. After Sam's death, he turned up on her doorstep, offering her a film contract in return for one night in her bed. But she'd already been signed to appear in Cecil B. DeMille's The Godless Girl, and threw him out on his ear. Therefore, the sight of him hopping from shoe to shoe at her hotel door was almost intriguing. His eyes flitted around from beneath his large dark brow. This didn't seem like the Harry Cohn that Lena was familiar with. This Harry Cohn appeared to be altogether more human. Anxiously, he cleared his throat and stammered a greeting, before holding out a long florist's box containing 3 dozen yellow roses. "What are you doing here, Mr. Cohn?" asked Lena.
"Call me Harry," he snapped. "I just wanted to give those to you."
He looked her up and down.
"Sweet fucking Christ, you're more beautiful than ever, doll. Getting pushed around sure agrees with you."
"How did you know which apartment I was in?" she said. Since the press attention had begun to intensify, she'd made it explicitly clear to the hotel manager that her room number was never to be divulged, no matter who was asking.
$20 at the desk downstairs, kiddo, and old Uncle Harry don't have no trouble. Ain't you gonna let me in?"
Frowning in confusion, and suddenly aware that she was wearing little more than her green silk pajamas, she pulled the door wider, and Cohn marched in, planting himself squarely on her couch and patting the space next to him. When she hesitated, he frowned and pointed at the florist box.
"Don't you like the flowers?" he said.
Sure.
"You should," he grinned. "They sure cost me a bundle. Hey, come over here and sit down. You're too far away."
Timidly, she perched on the edge of the couch, pulling the neckline around her pajamas closed.
"Think the flowers are nice? Wait till you see this fucking thing," he growled.
And reaching into his coat pocket, he produced a small green velvet box which he tossed onto the seat between them.
"Go ahead," he said.
Lena snapped open the lid and beheld a large diamond brooch resting on a tiny purple cushion. "Oh my God, it's gorgeous."
"You really like it? Cost a hell of a wad."
"It's beautiful. Who's it for?"
"Oh shit, Lena, it's yours."
He snatched up the brooch, fumbled open the clasp, then grabbed her left breast, deliberately taking his time in attaching it to her. When this gentle mauling was over, she looked at him questioningly.
"Look, I know this is out of the blue," he said, "but I want you, doll. There's never been a dame no place that I wanted so much. Lena, you need me too. I can make a rich life for you again. I'll set you up in style, a style so grand you can tell the whole shit-heel world to kiss your ass."
She studied his eyes, which flitted around like a housefly. Harry Cohn, the no-good son-of-a-bitch boss man, bully to thousands, and here he was, red-faced, sweat on his brow, nervous as a schoolboy asking a girl to prom. There was something almost attractive about seeing this shark suddenly acting like a courting teenager. "Why me, Harry?" she said.
"Nah, it's always been you," he murmured. "Shit, Lena, don't make me beg. I've been in love with you for years."
Without thinking, she reached slowly out and took his fumbling hand. He blew out a breath and tried to look her in the eye. "I'm flattered, Harry," said Lena. "Really, really flattered. Really, I am."
"Yeah."
"Yes," she said. "But Harry, remember that I know your wife."
"Now what's she got to do with it?" said Harry Cohn. "Just because we're married don't mean I love her."
"She's a nice lady. I don't want to be the one to hurt her."
"I told you," said Cohn. "We ain't in love no more. I know you and me can make it. I love you, doll. I've always been nuts about you, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to court you. Flowers, candy, the works. I'll be so good to you, Lena, that you'll fall in love with me. You'll see."
"Harry, you're sweet, but..."
"Plus, I want to have a kid with you."
Lena choked. "What did you say?" He grinned triumphantly and pointed to her stomach.
I want you to make me a kid.
With this, he clapped once and waited expectantly. Lena's face was frozen in confusion for long minutes.
Are you out of your mind? She said finally. A child? You're an idiot. We can't have a child. We're not married.
Ah, he said, waving this away. I'll get around to marrying you someday. Besides, Rose will give me a divorce if she knows I stuck a kid in you. She likes you, honey. She says all the time you got a raw deal from the Warner guys. I'll give her a big fat divorce settlement. We're all walking happy. You'll be the best kept dame since Marion Davis. Now, how's that for a deal?
The deal was, of course, politely refused, and yet over the coming days, Harry Cohn's admiration seemed to grow even more ardent. Already he choked my wardrobe with Hattie Carnegie and Lily Dash originals, said Lena. Shoes, bags, and lingerie were strewn around my suite, some not yet removed from boxes. I had an ankle-length white ermine coat, lavishly trimmed in sable. A wide diamond bracelet decorated my wrist, and on the third finger left hand, the one that had felt the bond of Sam's wedding ring. There now sparkled a huge diamond solitaire. Gradually, over the course of several intense days, Lena began to look forward to the calls, to the sight of him climbing from his car and waving, to the rough sandpaper in his voice. Strange, these men so ill-suited to her. Sam with his wise, quiet manner and large, gentle eyes, and now Harry Cohn with his permanent frown and his crude words. But more than the gifts, more than the financial security afforded to her by being Harry Cohn's girl, Lena Basquette realized that if she gave herself to him, body and soul, Hollywood's doors could once again be opened to her. Lena was not physically attracted to the dull glare he fixed on her breasts when they dined at restaurants, and found repellent the way his hand crushed her buttocks as they walked along together. He was a work in progress, she decided. There were many creases in this rough diamond that needed to be ironed out. Perhaps it might not be so bad, said her maid and confidant Irene, if you close your eyes and don't put the lights on. Their first tryst proper occurred a week after she'd agreed to a relationship. Determined to set the romantic tone she hoped would continue, Lena arranged for a lavish dinner to be sent to Harry Cohn's apartment at the Biltmore Hotel. This would be followed by brandies and soft music, during which time, Lena would slip quietly to the powder room to slide into a sheer negligee, and taking King Cohn by the hand, would lead him to the bedroom for an early night. By the end of the third course, Cohn had begun to bang his chest with his fist between mouthfuls, and his eyes, which had spent the first portion of the evening resting upon Lena's breasts, were now beginning to pink at the edges and searched the room about him as he struggled for breath.
Are you okay? Said Lena.
Fucking ulcers, he growled. Fucking indigestion.
He followed this information with a wet burp that sent to Lena's side of the table an aromatic summary of their dinner so far. She fixed him a bicarbonate of soda, administered it, and then fixed him another. Twice he rose from the table to fart and belch away his discomfort, believing that if he stood a mere meter away from his dining companion, then he was somehow invisible and noiseless. Finally, he threw down his cutlery in defeat and slapped the table with his palms.
I give the fuck up, he said. I'm gonna go take a shit.
Okay, she said. Look, I'm sorry about the food.
Ah, no,
he said, waving her away.
Not your fault. I've been constipated all day. Got a lot of gas in my gut.
Grunting, he rushed to the bathroom and slammed the door behind him. Hopeful of rescuing the evening, Lena took herself to the bedroom adjoining the bathroom, changed into her lingerie, applied merely the spirit of perfume to her skin, and reclined on the bed, slipping the strap from her shoulder. Her soundtrack to this moment of seduction was the growling, heaving voice of Harry Cohn from behind the bathroom door, as he fought and strained to expel all traces of the evening's meal from his body. Almost 20 minutes passed before he flung open the door, gasping for fresh air, his face haunted by his experiences.
He slouched towards the bed and slumped down beside the reclining Lena. Within moments, he was snoring like a drill. From time to time, he would jerk and moan in pain, thrashing around the bed and cursing.
I kept waking up and wondering if I was going to be lying next to a corpse, said Lena later. That would be all I needed, a dead Harry Cohn in bed with me. That would give the scandal vultures the juiciest clump of gossip to hit Hollywood since the Fatty Arbuckle mess.
So fretful did Lena become about this during the night that when morning came and Harry Cohn struggled to his feet, she began to kiss his face in relief.
Lena, you're a doll, he grunted with a crooked smile. Lots of dames would have left me flat last night. Wouldn't have cared whether I lived or died. I love you, little lady. You got class.
You're sweet, Harry, smiled Lena, experiencing a surge of genuine affection, and finally feeling as though maybe Harry Cohn had gotten the hang of this romance thing.
It's funny how things work out, he said. I've been waiting so long to bang you, and then my pecker dries up like a peanut.
And then again, maybe not. They agreed that when Lena's contract with Harry Richmond was up, she would follow Harry Cohn out to Hollywood, where a house and a wardrobe would be waiting. It just so happened that Harry Richmond, one of the most famous entertainers in the business at the time, had recently broken up with his actress girlfriend Clara Bow. For weeks now, the papers had been wild with the stories of the breakup, honing in particularly on the fact that in a fit of anger, Richmond had sued Bow when she'd refused to return the enormous diamond engagement ring he'd bought for her. The case had been dragged, kicking and screaming, through the courts, and in the end, Clara Bow had been forced to return the ring to Harry Richmond. With one of the most notorious ladies in America now due to star opposite him in his show, Richmond decided to stoke up a little more publicity by leaking out to the press the wild story that he had given the famous Clara Bow ring to his new co-star Lena Basquette. This wasn't helped by the fact that during a photo call, Lena was snapped wearing the huge diamond ring that Harry Cohn had sent to her. Richmond bowls over Basquette with Bow's ring, read the headline the following morning, and within minutes of its publication, Harry Cohn was bawling down the phone at her.
Why the ever-loving shit is that pussy pounder Richmond giving you rings?
He yelled. It's your damn ring, she fired back. Look at it.
I am looking at it. It's a diamond ring. They all look the same to me. How do I know it's my ring?
Harry, she said, they are trying to use me for publicity. You should be wise to what jazzed up publicity blurbs are. Your studio sends out dozens of them every day.
Go jump in a can of shit.
How dare you talk to me like that?
I was warned about you, you bitch.
He snarled.
And if you think I'm gonna sit back and watch that greaseball making love to you on the front pages, you both have another thing coming. I'm gonna have that goddamn shit-sucker bumped off if it's the last thing I do. I got Capone connections. Richmond's life ain't worth a pile of horseshit.
Phooey! She yelled back and slammed down the phone on Harry Cohn and their brief engagement. To perk up his leading lady's disposition, Richmond invited her to his Long Island mansion for a party he was holding that weekend. During the limousine ride, his hand found Lena's knee more than a few times, and by the time they'd arrived, she was exhausted from fighting him off. The front door was opened to them, and they were immediately assaulted by deafening jazz, the damp heat of a dancing crowd, and the artless mayhem of 100 voices. At the edges of the floor, against the walls, were lined dozens of empty hooch bottles, some on their sides. Dancers filled each doorway, and on the stairs, couples reclined upon each other, skirts pulled high, shirts unbuttoned, lost in each other's kisses. Within moments of arriving, Richmond himself had been accosted away by delirious party girls, and somewhat relieved, Lena pushed her way to the quietest part of the house and sank into an armchair, slipping off her shoes. She closed her eyes, laid her head back, and sighed in exhaustion. "You're not enjoying yourself, are you?" came a voice from behind her. She turned to see a man with sandy hair and a crooked yet oddly perfect smile, leaning on the wall behind her, his hands in his pockets. "No, I'm not enjoying myself," she said. "How did you notice?" "You look bored." "Hey, guess what?" he said. I'm about to use the grandest cliche in the big book of cliches, but it's a question I genuinely want the answer to. What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Firstly, said Lena, there is nothing grand about that cliche, and secondly, what makes you think I'm a nice girl? The man grinned and blushed, and Lena felt herself melt a little. Sit down, won't you? She said, shifting sideways in her chair. Talk to me a while. He hesitated a moment, and then placed himself next to her. Anyone ever told you you look like a teddy bear? She said. Anyone ever told you that you're... He stopped and drew a breath, studying her face with what she could only suppose was wonder. Damn, he whispered. Where did you learn how to talk to girls? Said Lena. The big book of cliches, he said. Pretty useful book. They both giggled. My name is Ray Hallam, he said. The name chimed somewhere in Lena's memory. Ray Hallam from New York or something, straight from Broadway. Starred in a couple of shows with James Cagney. The chiming grew dim. She held out a hand. It's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Hallam, she said. My name is... I know who you are, he said. You're the beautiful Lena Basquette. I wasn't going to come tonight, but then Richmond told me you were coming with him, and I said to myself, stick around, fella. Here's your chance. Your chance? She asked. To meet a real-life goddess, said Hallam. Man doesn't get a chance like that very often. You kind of have to grab them when they come around. He studied the edges of her face, reached up and tilted her head to one side, comically studying her jawline. Anyone ever tell you how perfect you are? No one, she said. You must associate with a basket of schmucks, he said. You're pretty much the prototype, kiddo. Sorry for manhandling you. I just wanted to see if you were for real. Lena felt a heat in her cheeks that she hadn't felt since Sam. And am I? For real? She said. Lena Basquette, he smiled. You are everything that they said you were. The song behind them changed, and as it did, a cry of delight from the hundreds of revelers, followed by the rhythmic stamping of dancing heels. Lena, he said, do you want to get out of here? Yes, I do, she replied. The night that Lena Basquette and Ray Hallam fell in love was like the passing of a comet, brief and spectacular. It began with a ride on Harry Richmond's rowboat, stolen by Ray from Richmond's private jetty. Half an hour later, they'd packed their cases and fled in Ray's car to New York and the Algonquin Hotel. Just 6 hours had passed since they'd met, but by the time they'd arrived at the Algonquin's front desk, these two almost strangers were madly in love. Ray Hallam's eyes never left Lena, and his hands seemed constantly to touch her, to stroke her fingers as she signed the register, against the small of her back as she passed before him. They brushed the nape of her neck as they stood together at the hotel window and looked out over the havoc of New York City. And yet, this over-attention did not feel unnatural. His constant professions of adoration did not come from a desire to drag her to the nearest bed, but to ensure that come the morning, she would still be there. There was something uncanny about their meeting, something enchanted and predestined, as though everything up until this point in her life had been leading to Ray Hallam and his lazy, crooked smile. Over dinner on their first night at the Algonquin, she told him about her father, about her mother, about dancing in the Follies. She told him about Sam Warner and Lita and $100,000. She told him about drinking poison after a party, and as she did so, the scissors in her throat flashed once more. She ended with the short engagement to Harry Cohn and the relentless pursuit of the news hounds. In return, he told her about his life, of his abandonment by his own parents as an infant, and the chaotic adventures of his youth,
And as he reflected on them, he grinned and lost himself for moments in tales of swiping apples and kissing ministers' daughters and playing stickball in Central Park. I survived, though, he said. I had a knack for drama, so I joined a drama school. That's how I met Papa Case. Papa Case? She asked. Frank Case, he replied. He runs things here at the Algonquin Hotel. That's how I can live here. In fact, this meal was a gift from him. I won't lie to you, Lena. I don't have money, and I'm a proud son of a bitch, but I kind of want to marry you. Is that okay? That's okay, she smiled. We'll have to manage on what I earn, or we'll starve and sleep in Central Park. What do you say? Can you live on love alone? Lena laughed and snatched his hand. Why the hell aren't I running for my life? She said. Yes, Ray, for some crazy reason I think that I can live on love alone. I'm very glad to hear that, he said. Because I've loved you for longer than I care to admit. Since last night, said Lena. Ray chuckled. No, gorgeous. I've been in love with you since I hustled nickels and dimes at the stage door of the New Amsterdam. Lena's breath stopped. It was back in 24, he said, jumping up and holding out his arms. He sang the first verse of Yankee Doodle Dandy and fell back into his seat, bellowing with laughter. You, she gasped. You remember me? He frowned. God, I had a good thing going back then with my George M. Cohan imitation. I made all the stage doors, a few saloons, helped put me through drama school, and then one night, beautiful little Lena Basket, La Ballerina, gave me a 50-cent piece. You didn't throw it at me like the others did, so I'd have to scramble like a beggar on the sidewalk. You put the coin in my hand and smiled. And I fell madly in love with the goddess. And just as I did, the wicked witch, your mother, yanked you away. Lena shook her head in disbelief. I've kept that memory for so long, she said. I'll never forget looking back as we rounded that corner. I tried to follow you, said Ray. I was going to camp outside whichever hotel you went into, but there was a crowd and I don't know. You must have caught a cab or something. He smiled, kissed her hand, and then got up and walked into his bedroom. Lena heard a drawer slide open and then close. Ray returned and held out a small object. She took from him a brightly polished 50-cent piece and turned it in her fingers. I went hungry more than once rather than part with it, he said. She looked up and felt tears in her eyes. Years I waited to see you again, he said. Now you know why I was at Harry's party. I took an awfully big chance that I wouldn't be disillusioned. Lena stood and cupped Ray Hallam's face with her hands. Why did you wait so long to find me? She said. You've been running on a fast track, dream girl. The rush of love that shook Lena Basket at Ray Hallam's words in that moment almost threatened to take her legs from beneath her. She pressed a tearful kiss against his lips as the sun went down on the New York City landscape just beyond their window. The following day, Ray and Lena appeared at Harry Richmond's club, where they found him in his obsessively ordered dressing room, reclining on a polished chaise longue. He was draped in a purple silken dressing gown and smoking a cigarette through a holder almost 2 feet long. Harry smirked as they entered. The runaways, he said. And what do you two have to say for yourselves? Sorry for skipping out on your party, Harry, Lena said. Oh, I don't mind you skipping out, said Harry. But you could have waited until after I'd had my wicked way with you. I was so looking forward to it. We're in love, Harry, said Ray. Well, that's a fine thing to say about the girl you stole from me, said Harry. And just where the hell does all this in-love crap leave me? Personally or professionally, said Ray. Professionally, of course. Personally, my boy. Our pretty pussy face here means no more to me than any other. Careful, Harry, Ray growled. We've come to tell you that Lena wants out of the show.
The two men's eyes met for a moment, and then Harry Richmond swung around into a seated position and crossed his legs, raising an eyebrow at Lena. "You know I have you under contract, right?" he said. "My lawyers and associates can make it mighty tough on you if you run out on me, and let me warn you that some of my associates can play awful rough."
"Cut the threats, Harry," said Ray.
"I know a few rough boys myself who don't care much for your rough boys."
"Both of you, shut your mouths," snapped Lena. "Now listen, Harry, I want out. I want you to tear up that contract tonight, without recriminations."
"Why should I?" smiled Richmond. "As I've told you before, Peach Blossom, we are a gold mine together." "No, Harry, you're the gold mine."
"Clever to appeal to the Richmond vanity, my pet," said Harry. "But you are what the act needs. You've got great timing, a lot of hidden talents, and the crowds are banging the doors to get in and spend money. How can I let you go?"
Lena knelt in front of Harry's seat and took his hand. "Be an angel, Richmond," she said. "Can't you see? I'm desperately in love with Ray goddamn Hallam back there. I want to live with him and darn his socks and bake some fucking cakes for the guy. We want to be married."
"Married?" cried Richmond, jumping to his feet and staring at them incredulously. "I don't believe it." "Come on, pussyface, stop kidding around. This is a goddamn fling."
"Not a fling," said Ray. "We're going to get married in the next day or two." Harry Richmond stared at them both in turn.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
"We're serious," said Lena. "We're Beethoven's Fifth serious." Harry Richmond drew long on the ridiculous cigarette holder and blew the smoke slow and steady until it was a genie that floated amongst them. Then he removed his slipper and hurled it with a thump at the door. A moment passed, and the nervous, inquisitive face of Richmond's secretary appeared.
"Lillian," he cried, "bring me this baggage's contract, plus my wallet and a bottle of champagne."
The face disappeared and Richmond began to pace the floor.
"I'll be damned," he muttered. "I'll be damned. Married. Doomed and married. You know, I feel almost responsible for the thing, seeing as how you met at my party."
Lena squeezed Ray's hand to stop him from saying anything. If Richmond wanted to believe he was Cupid, then best to let him believe.
"Ray," said Harry, placing a hand on his shoulder. "Good luck, fella. Damn it, Hallam, you deserve happiness."
A darkness suddenly flickered across Ray Hallam's face, and Lena frowned. The door opened and Lillian appeared, handing a small collection of objects to Harry. The contract upon which Lena had signed her name was torn in two, the two bundles handed to her with a grin. From Richmond's wallet was extracted a thick stack of assorted banknotes that Richmond did not bother to count. As Lena protested, Richmond pressed it into her hands. "A wedding present," he told her. Richmond snatched up the champagne bottle and tore off the cork with a snap. He poured half its contents into a large tumbler, sank it in one, then refilled it and drank that one too.
"Holy Moses, Hallam," he said. "It kind of tears me up you found love so late."
"So late?" said Lena. She looked at Ray, whose face was pale with alarm. Richmond frowned.
"He's told you, right?"
An hour later, Lena knew everything. Ray Hallam was living on borrowed time. Cancer had set in young, the bone marrow kind, of which there was no cure. The first hours were spent in tears, Lena refusing to believe that Ray Hallam's time was about to come. Following this, a brief spell of anger, Lena furious that it had taken Hallam until the end of his life to make her fall in love with him. She would not be his widow, she cried. Would not believe that something couldn't be done somehow, somewhere, by somebody. And through the many stages of Lena Basquiat's grief, Ray Hallam remained silent, regarding this broken-hearted creature with quiet sadness. "I came to the conclusion a long time ago," said Ray, when her words finally stopped, "that we're all of us living on borrowed time. It's just that some of us have their credit extended longer than others. Maybe it would have been better to have never found you again, but I felt selfish about it, Lena. It's a long shot, I told myself. Maybe she won't even give me a second glance. But then again, maybe she will." I've never wanted much. I've been happy to just get by. But knowing that your time is winding down, it gives you perspective. It makes you grab the things you really want. And I've never wanted anything as much as I wanted you. Ever since I was a kid. It's okay that you're angry. Get it all out. God knows I did. And when you're done, I would love the opportunity to spend a short but beautiful time with you. Lena buried her head in Ray Hallam's chest and cried until her heart ran dry. A week later, in the invisible town of Hope, Arizona, they married at a run-down shack that the town parson called home. Lena's wedding ring was a band of silver, upon which was mounted a rough nugget of milky blue turquoise. They were a few days into the cross-country car trip from New York to Hollywood, where Ray hoped to find work at, of all places, Harry Cohn's Columbia Studios, and where Lena hoped to begin her new career as willing homemaker. The offer of an interview at Columbia had arrived just before they'd started out on their journey, and Lena was still trying to decipher Harry Cohn's play. Was he genuinely interested in Ray's talents? Or did he want to berate her happiness in front of the man she'd found in the wake of their brief engagement? They rode the foothills and potholes of America, sharing driving duties and sleeping in shifts, the passenger's head always bouncing on the shoulder of the driver as they passed through the heart of the country and on ever westward. They arrived to a sock drawer of an apartment on Fountain Avenue and spent 2 days playing gramophone records and sleeping late. The night before his audience with Harry Cohn, Ray fetched Chinese food and danced with Mrs. Hallam around the straw rug in the living room until the evening turned to purple and all the lamps were lit. As Lena closed the last of the windows to keep out the chill, she noticed him leaning against the wall of the room, one hand pressed to his chest, 1,000 wet pearls of sweat on his face. "Ray, are you okay?" "Sure," he managed. "I'm all right, don't worry." "I will worry. Sit down," she snapped, rushing to his side and easing him down onto a chair. She rushed to the kitchen and fetched a glass of water, holding it to his scorched lips. As he drank, she took his hand and felt for his pulse. "Your heart's beating like a fire engine," she said. "I'll be okay," he said. "It must be all the dancing." "You need to sleep," she said. "Later, I want to talk to you about tomorrow, about Cohn. Tell me what he's like." "We'll talk in the morning," said Lena, taking his arm. He wriggled away and shook his head. "No, we'll talk about it now." Ray caught his breath, sipped the last of the water and fixed his eyes upon her. His hand closed over hers, and as it did, she felt it jitter slightly, and then calm and begin to cool. "Harry's a stinker," she said. "But he knows talent, and way down deep, there's a glimmer of decency in him. Sure, he can be vile, but I don't think he'll blackball you because of me, because of what passed between Harry and I." Ray nodded. His breath seemed calm now. If his eyes weren't so pink, Lena wouldn't have believed that any attack had taken place at all. But even as this thought crossed her mind, a brief pain seemed to clutch at Ray somewhere behind his eyes, which clenched shut, and the rest of the night was spent in dark silence as Ray tried and failed to sleep. The following morning, they were shown into Harry Cohn's office, walked the 40 feet to his oversized desk, and took seats on chairs with tiny legs so that King Cohn could look down on them both.
"Hey, doll," he said to Lena.
And then to Ray, he said simply,
"You Hallam?"
"Yes, Mr. Cohn, I'm Ray Hallam, sir." Cohn frowned and studied Ray's face. As he did, the phone at his hand rang and he snatched it up.
"No, you listen to me, you motherfucker! Take the deal or shove it up your ass." "Yeah, that's what I said, jerkaroo. Take it or leave it. Tits like that come a dime a dozen.
The receiver was smashed back into place, and King Cone's gaze rested once more upon the nervous Hallam.
I heard you used to box, kid.
That's right, sir.
You ever meet Dempsey?
Yes, sir. I carried his sponge and water a few times.
What was your boxing name?
Rocky Hale, sir.
Rocky Hale,
said Cone, turning the name over a few times.
I like it better than Ray Cream Puff Hallam. A name in this racket can make or break you. If I tell you to change your name, will you do it?
Ray glanced at Lena. I'll have to discuss it with Lena, Mr. Cone.
You work at my studio, then I'm your boss, and I make all your decisions for you, said Cone. Got that?
Ray swiveled in his chair to face Lena and smiled. What do you say, dream girl? Said Ray. Should I work here?
What did you call her?
Said Cone. Dream girl, sir. Cone rolled his eyes.
I called her doll.
Harry, said Lena, you can give Ray a break, can't you? Put him in a Capra picture or something. He'll be a big star for you, I promise.
You was agent doll?
Said Cone. Of course not, she said. But I know that if you give him the right opportunity...
Kinda sold on you, ain't she, kid?
Sighed Cone, shuffling papers on his desk and not meeting their eyes. We're kind of sold on each other, Mr. Cone, said Ray. Harry Cone muttered something to himself and rolled his eyes again.
Okay, kid, I'll give you a shot, said Cone. I've heard enough good stuff about you, and I know talent. Come and meet me tomorrow, and we'll work out in the gym. Talk about your contract. 5:30, and don't stand me up or I'll have you shot.
Lena sprang from her chair and raced to Harry Cone's side, and before he could object, she'd planted a kiss on his cheek and whispered her thanks into his ear. As they left, Cone shook Ray's hand and said,
You got yourself quite a dame, kid. Hold on to her. She's a funny broad.
I'll hold on to her, sir, Ray said. Cone scowled.
Can that sir crap? Makes me sound like an old goat.
The next day, Ray Hallam did not arrive for his appointment with Harry Cone. He would leave no footprints at Grauman's Chinese, said Lena much later. He would never return to Broadway in triumph, never see the Grand Canyon. In the prime of his young life, he was felled by an insidious malignancy against which there was no defense. Just 1 hour after arriving home from his meeting with King Cone, Ray Hallam collapsed at Lena's feet and spent 2 days pleading his desperate whispers of love for Lena Basquette as she stared hopelessly into his eyes and begged him not to leave her. On day 3, she received a call from Harry Cone.
You need any dough, doll?
He croaked. Thanks, Harry, but no. We're okay.
I'm sorry your guy's sick. He's a nice kid. You gonna be all right?
I don't know.
You know, I could send you my doctor. It won't cost you nothing.
That's sweet of you, Harry. I'm grateful, but the doctors are already here.
You're one hell of a broad. Good luck, doll.
The last words that Ray Hallam uttered came later that evening, when for the 100th time that day, he told Lena that he loved her. She held his head in her arms and kissed his face as their doctor pressed an inquisitive stethoscope around his chest. Finally, he looked at Lena gravely and shook his head. Just before we reached the California border on our trip to Hollywood, said Lena later, Ray had stopped the car and said, When my number's up, bury me in this wasteland. I was born with no fanfare. Let me leave the same way. No excess baggage, Lena. I want to travel light. So there was to be no granite headstone, just a wooden marker. 2 Mexican laborers carried the coffin brought by train and truck. A padre and I stood in a swirl of desert sand and watched one of God's sparrows return to the barren bosom of the earth.
On the train ride back to Hollywood, and in the weeks that followed, Lena mourned with what was left of her heart, lost in a black grief and dizzy with doubt about not only her future, but that of Ray Hallam's child, sleeping softly in her belly.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to continue this epic story immediately, then go on over now to patreon.com/attaboysecret or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. Hear every thrill, every drama, every heartbreak, every spellbinding moment. Unlock the secret history of Hollywood now at patreon.com/attaboysecret. Or follow the link in the show notes of this episode. And thank you.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.